This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Let's go over to another topic that we're covering. Alec Murdaugh walked into a Lexington County courtroom in double shackles and an orange jumpsuit, his first appearance since the Supreme Court threw out his murder convictions. What happened over the next hour told you everything about how the defense is preparing for the April 5th of 2027 trial. Mark your calendars now. Take off from work. Get the kids out of school and get some popcorn. 8 new expert witnesses, first responder transcripts, suggesting other people were at Moselle that night, a demand for DNA testing using the same lab that cracked the Koberger case, and a fight over whether the defendant gets to look like a human being in front of the cameras. Bob Mata's with myself and Robin Drake as we break down all of this. Right now, it's a lot of procedural motions. They're trying to plan this, and as we all know, most cases, so much of it takes place before the actual trial in terms of where this thing is going. One of the things that they're asking for Alec is to have a laptop in prison. Not a crazy ask. I mean, he's got to be part of his defense as well. No other inmate gets one, but there's a lot of paper. There's boxes and boxes and boxes of paperwork, as it's been argued. The judge said no. But she did offer a conference room instead. Harpudlin said without digital access to discovery, he'd need a year. Is this a fair compromise there, Bob? Is it okay that he doesn't have a computer, or are we already seeing them, you know, really tightening the noose around Alec in his own participation of his defense?
I mean, it's a tough call.
Yeah.
I the defendant should have access to the discovery in his case. It's not unusual for defendants not to be left with discovery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do I think that he should be given access maybe for certain periods of time where he has access to a laptop that has, you know, the flash drives or the hard drives, the external hard drives connected to it so that he can comb through it for a bit? I think that he should. Do I think that he should be able to have a laptop in his computer 24/7? No.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think there's going to be a judge on the planet that would allow a defendant that kind of access.
He's still convicted of the other crimes.
Yeah,
but different crimes.
Right, different
crimes. But he's still in jail for it, so
yeah.
He's still a prisoner.
All
right.
So, do I think that there's a potential Sixth Amendment type issue? Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I mean, the thing is with it, it's like, does it hurt anything if he plays a little minesweeper on the side to prevent a chance of another appeal or another successful appeal? You see, you want to make sure everything is just reduce the odds of this. We don't want to talk about Alec Murdaugh for the next 20 years. Another thing that was brought up, Harpudlin brought up the first responder transcripts. This is kind of interesting. To the court, he told the judge other people were at Moselle that night whose accounts don't match. Okay. I mean, it's lawyer speak. You know, it sounds big. It sounds exciting. It sounds interesting. Maybe there's something to it. How far can the defense go with that without naming an alternative suspect if they're going to go down that road? How specific do they need to get? Do they need to get all the way like Karen Reed style, where they're saying there are these people in the house that did these things, but we're not going to really get into super great detail other than they might have had something? Can it be to that vague of level? How specific does the defense need to go in the Murdaugh case? How far can they go without getting more specific?
If you can connect the person to the crime, and usually if you can place a person within the proximity,
mm-hmm.
you're cooking with gas at that point. You know, it's a different thing. Like with the Reed thing, you know, that wasn't just some random people. That was people where this guy was supposed to be heading, and there was
sure,
yeah. You know, they found him on the lawn like mm-hmm. that. Like that is, you know, and in that case, Canone, she allowed the third party culprit to come in through Bowden, which is mm-hmm. the Massachusetts case talking about, you know, the lack of an investigation or the poor investigation ultimately. But here, you kind of have some of those same problems with SLED's investigation.
Yes.
We talked about it a bit last week.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you can put people in that area, like you said, there's got to be some connective tissue. You just can't pick random people, you know, out of thin air and be like, that guy seems like a guy who, you know, it's got to be more than that. And if you can put somebody at or around a crime scene at the time that it took place, at that point, you've got something going. Whether or not it's going to be admissible, we still might need more, but at least you're there. Because if you can't place anybody specifically within that area, it's dead in the water. Like, you have to at least have that kind of connective tissue.
So all they have to do is show, because that's my question, Bob, because again, I don't know this side of it that well. So all they have to do, that if they don't have to actually say name someone or even a position or a job title of someone, they just have to say other people around there to deflect off of him as a possible third party, and that's what that can be a defense, or they actually have to name. So in other words, reverse fishing expedition.
You can't just say other people. Like, they don't necessarily have to hand over the killer, right? Like, that is not something that you have to do. But I mean, like, the case that we're all, you know, relatively passionate about, I'm exceptionally passionate about, Tony's pretty passionate about, you know, Richard Allen.
Yeah, me too.
You know, we've got a guy with the initials EF that puts himself at the crime scene, that says that he left DNA at the crime scene, that seemed to know something about the placement of sticks around the body, and Gull didn't let the defense bring him in, you know, but Gull was not a good judge. You know what I'm saying? Like, and in that particular situation, you had the names,
right?
You know, and whether or not you believed their alibis, which I don't, you know, and I don't think that they were properly vetted. I don't think that they did the work that they needed to do. So, I mean, you can't just say it was some random. You're going to have to give some kind of detail.
Yeah,
like it can't be so wide open in terms of the defense throwing a third party culprit. You've got to give something for the jury to hang their hat on. It can't just be, well, you know, I mean, if you have enough to say, all right, look, we had two samples that we pulled, okay, from the crime scene. You know, one was based on DNA that we found on Maggie, and we haven't been able to get a match of the profile, but we have been able to match it with all the known profiles. So we know that it was nobody in the family. We know that it was nobody in law enforcement that was there at the scene. So we've been able to eliminate all the people that it's not, based on people that we know that were at the scene. I mean, like, it'll be a highly litigated issue.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Could they, but part of that thing, could they then tie it to, you know, one of the things that we've been throwing around as a loose possibility is, all right, drug cartel hit to get retribution, and the guy, we can't find him because this hit guy fled back across the border. Is that loose enough or tight enough, and actually to deflect that way and say that's a third party type of culprit?
I mean, I don't know, but I don't think so. But I think what you're looking at probably is more likely than not, if you've got unknown profiles that have been pulled from the scene and they're not able to come up with a name because they're not in CODIS, they're not able to do it. You know, you're pointing to the fact that there is unknown profiles that exist.
You could point an unsub.
Right. You know, and I mean, you're certainly allowed to do that and say, look, you know, then you're dealing with the thing that we were talking about on last week's episode, wherein we're saying, okay, it doesn't appear that Maggie had any kind of defensive wounds. This doesn't appear to have been a struggle. You know, like this is a homicide that took place from a distance. So at what point would anybody have had the opportunity to have, you know, Maggie scratched them to where she's getting DNA under her fingernail. Right. You know, so it's like you're having to deal with that if you're the defense, in terms of, because I think the prosecution has a pretty damn strong argument that whatever it was is completely innocent. What, like, it was, she was getting a, you know, a mani and pedicure, and you know, it was from the nail tech or whatever the case may be. You could pick up DNA anywhere. You know what I'm saying? So
when you unpack this case again and we look at all the evidence, and yes, there was really bad parts of this investigation, without a doubt. And you need reasonable doubt here. But any way you look at it, it looks pretty ick for Alec Murdaugh. Like the timing, I know they're going to try and argue. They're going to try like, see, the timing was off originally, and there was more time between this. I don't know how they're going to do it, but they're going to find a way. So all these little things that still look pretty ick towards him. Like, yeah, but it still pretty much looks like there's nobody else that, or at the very least, you were there and you know something, whether you did it or not. Is this a case that for Alec Murdaugh, it's not going to be one going down those lanes? Is this a case that could be won for Alec Murdaugh by getting more of his family up there and showing just how far of a deviation this would be from his character to do something like this and really try to sell the jury on that? And I got to ask, how difficult is that going to be round two? Everybody in round one, we're pretty sympathetic figures to Alec Murdaugh, the family that went up there and testified about what a loving father he was, blah, 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 blah. They may have a little different opinions this time around, knowing how vile Alec actually is, to get the real convincing rah, rah, he's a family man. Do you rely more on that than you do a third party or timing or slight inconsistencies or trying to poke holes in a shitty investigation?
I think if you're the defense in this particular trial, you are attacking their entire timeline and all their forensic evidence. Like they did it to some extent, you know, but we had the bizarre, you know, two little gray men video that they get, like their shit was not good.
Yeah.
Like the defense that they put on in terms of countering the state's forensic evidence and especially digital evidence was not good. You know, I think that they're going to spend a lot more time and money in terms of attacking that evidence, because essentially, remember, Murdaugh was one of the first cases, if not the first case that I'm aware of, at least, wherein they basically established a time of death based on usage of cell phone and when that stopped. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, that is when they determined that Maggie died, you know, based on when, and Paul for that matter. So, you know, they're going to have to really kind of like dig into that particular evidence through expert testimony and put on a convincing case, because, you know, I don't know what the inner workings are with Buster and his father. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know, you know, because I think that there's an argument to be made if you're of the mindset that, you know, which I've always been of the mindset that Murdaugh, throughout the course of his life as a family man, deeply loved his family.
Yeah.
You know, which has always been my biggest hurdle in terms of him being the actual one to pull the triggers.
Me too.
You know, like it's just always been my thing. And like, I don't give a shit if people are going to lose their minds in chat. I don't care. You're not changing my mind. And you know, there is that concept. It was his drug use so prevalent that his mind was scrambled and he wasn't thinking clearly at all at any point, and that just drove him to do this unthinkable thing where in any other situation, you know, it never would be something he'd be capable of. Maybe, like, I certainly can't say it's not, because it certainly exists in the world that Alec did it, right? Like, for sure. You know what I'm saying? Like, my thing has always been, if he came up with this crazy, you know, if the state's motive matches to what actually happened in terms of he's trying to, you know, squirrel, look over here, look at all this, look at this trauma I'm going through. Like, how can you be coming after me when I'm going through all this shit right over here? You know, and he's trying to stall, you know, the impending storm. what does Creighton call it? The gathering storm.
The gathering storm of the family annihilator. I mean, it's going to be fascinating to see where they go with this in terms of the defense. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. Links are in the description.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.